The problem with former CIA agents becoming the arbiters of what is true and what is false and what should be promoted and what should be deleted is that they cut their teeth at the notorious organization whose job it was to inject lies and false information into the public discourse to further the goals of the national security state. John Stockwell, former head of a CIA task force, explained on camera how his organization infiltrated media departments the world over, created fake newspapers and news agencies, and planted fake news about Washington's enemies. "I had propagandists all over the world," he said. This continues to this day, with the CIA promoting dubious stories about the so-called Havana Syndrome. And all this is to say nothing about the coup attempts on foreign governments, the drug and weapons smuggling, and the worldwide network of black sites where thousands are tortured. Furthermore, many of the ex-CIA employees listed participated in some of the worst crimes against humanity of the 21st century, the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and are clearly proud of it. So while there is admittedly a limited pool of qualified people for roles in cybersecurity, it is wholly inappropriate that Google is employing so many spooks to run their most sensitive, influential operations. And it is especially troubling that so many of the individuals mentioned throughout were plucked directly from the CIA to work at Google, a fact that suggests that either Google is actively recruiting from the intelligence services or that there is some sort of backroom deal between Silicon Valley and the national security state. Elizabeth Murray, a retired intelligence agent who spent 27 years at the CIA and other intelligence organizations, explained how Google might benefit from hiring former spies. "By snagging a CIA employee, a company can save a considerable sum," she told Min Press, noting that these individuals have been highly trained and likely have a security clearance, something that is exceptionally different to attain in civilian organizations. In terms of benefit to the CIA, a CIA officer could spend several years acquiring a unique set of skills at a social media conglomerate and then return to the agency, paralyzing their newly acquired expertise to the benefit of the agency, Murray added. Even if there is nothing explicitly nefarious about this relationship, it still means that Google will start to think like and see problems the same way as the CIA does. Google has become immensely powerful, transforming itself into a behemoth that dominates online communication, commerce, information gathering, entertainment, and more. But Google is different. You can ignore or choose not to use those other platforms. Google, on the other hand, is far too big to escape from. An inordinate amount of Google's intelligence and security teams appear to come from the intelligence and security services. These include the following individuals: Deborah Witowski, who between 1999 and 2018 rose up the CIA's ranks, becoming chief of staff to the director. She left the agency for Google, where she is now vice president of global intelligence. Chelsea Magnant also left the CIA for Google in 2018, leaving an 8-year career as a political analyst for a job as a global threat analyst for the tech giant. Young Sok Lee spent 22 years at the CIA, leaving to take a position in global risk analysis and global security at Google. In May, he was promoted to become a director, and so many other people in the list. The professional background of so many of his security and risk management staff may go a long way to explaining why Google seems focused on countering threats from official enemy states of the United States. This is despite the fact that the United States is carrying out the largest and most extensive attempt in history to manipulate the Internet. A long expose in Newsweek last year detailed how the Pentagon alone fields a clandestine army of at least 60,000 individuals whose job it is to ruthlessly run national security state propaganda campaigns online, calling it the largest undercover force the world has ever known. The expose explained that there are the cutting-edge cyber fighters and intelligence collectors who assume false persons online, employing non-attribution and misattribution techniques to hide the who and the where of their online presence while they search for high-value targets and collect what is called publicly accessible information or even engage in campaigns to influence and manipulate social media. Thus, it is clear that former CIA personnel are deeply embedded within the Silicon Valley giant. Of course, Google is a huge company with thousands of employees. It could therefore be argued that it is unsurprising that some number of former national security state agents work for it, especially those who have the rare and highly developed skills necessary to preside over user privacy and safety. But this tolerance of spooks in the ranks is not applied evenly. Indeed, the very idea seems absurd. Yet dozens of Google employees casually note on public websites that they worked for the CIA and appear to see that as entirely unproblematic. Therefore, this relationship is, at best, inappropriate, and at worst, a U.S. government power play to control cyberspace. Google users frequently say they want more agency over their data, but the only agency they get is the central intelligence kind.
Worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
Part 1.
Big dreams burn down in these flames. The dreams of a young man who wanted to conquer the world with petrodollars and an iron fist. On June 21st, 2017, international media reported that a silent coup was underway in the corridors of power in Riyadh. King Salman, the ailing Saudi monarch, deposed Mohammed bin Nayef, the crown prince, and his nephew, and replaced him with his own son, Mohammed bin Salman. But for many, it wasn't news. On January 10th, 2016, The Independent had published an article from Germany's intelligence agency that said they expected King Salman to officially introduce bin Salman as his successor and delegate power. At that time, almost 10 months had passed since the Saudi aggression on Yemen. During the 10 months, the horrifying aspects of the humanitarian crisis came to light. On June 14, 2015, 2 months after the war, the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs reported the spread of dengue fever in Yemen and the deaths of 113 people. Only a few weeks later, on July 1st, the UN described Yemen as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. over 80% of the people needed immediate food and medical aid. The country is just one step away from famine. By besieging Yemen, bin Salman wanted to check the strength of the Ansarullah and Houthi forces and also trigger a popular uprising against the Ansarullah by cutting food supplies. Since the Saudi pilots weren't skillful enough, Saudi bombs would constantly target children, women, schools, and wedding ceremonies. Human Rights Watch reported that 309 civilians were killed in airstrikes until August 30, 2015, less than 6 months since the war. What did Mohammed bin Salman want with this poor nation that's on the verge of famine? How would he benefit from the lethal and bloody airstrikes? Some believe that he had his big dream, the dream of turning Saudi Arabia into the biggest power in the region and turning himself into the most powerful man in West Asia. But his dream faced a big hurdle. Iran, a country that's naturally been the heavyweight in the region for centuries. The Saudis accused Iran of intervention in Yemen and seek to introduce Ansarullah as evidence of Iran's influence in the region. It seems history is repeating itself. The story of Iran in Yemen has started once again. Ali Abdullah Saleh ruled Yemen for 3 decades. Before that, he was the president of North Yemen for many years. This is the museum he established to mark his own presidency after he resigned. His resignation did not mean that he wouldn't return to Yemen's political arena. Saleh had surrendered during the revolution in Yemen and delegated power to Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi and left the country for the U.S. under the pretext of medical treatment. On February 19, 2014, UN envoy Jamal Ben Omar announced that Saleh could take part in the upcoming elections in Yemen. At that time, Saleh was pursuing his own goals and got closer to the Houthis to make a unity with them. In terms of tribal divisions, the Houthis are Zaydis, just like him, and more importantly, they're considered Yemen's main power. If he sought a future in Yemen, he had to form an alliance with the Houthis. The coalition was eventually formed on August 10, 2016, between the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh. The coalition was aimed at putting up a resistance front against Saudi raids. Parts of the Yemeni army still took orders from Saleh. The Houthis needed his power for the war. Saleh, too, needed the Houthis' influence in order to regain power. As long as they could find a solution for the Saudi attacks, it was a win-win situation for both sides. But the Ansarullah leader didn't trust Saleh that much. He had to choose either of the two. Mohammed bin Salman, an ambitious Saudi young man who had launched an invasion on Yemen with all of its force on the one hand, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, a Yemeni dictator who was ready to join him in the fight against Saudi Arabia for now. October 8, 2016, some horrifying news from Yemen left the world in shock. Saudi forces bombed a funeral ceremony. 155 people were killed and 525 people were wounded. The number of fatalities on that day was more than half of the fatalities during the first 2 months of Saudi airstrikes on Yemen. Gradually, public opinion in the world sympathized with the Yemeni people. Images from Yemen were the most horrifying images in the world. However, Houthi revolutionaries were under immense pressure.
لم تكن شكوك السيد عبد الملك الحوثي خاطئة. سرعان ما توضح.
There was a good reason why Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of the Ansarullah movement, was so hesitant. Soon it came to light that Saleh was hand in glove with the Saudi-led coalition. The United Arab Emirates was supposed to play a secondary role in the war, a country behind Saudi Arabia. But UAE officials pursued their own aspirations. They know that Saudi Arabia is dreaming about becoming the regional leader and historically consider countries like the UAE as part of their own land. Saudi Arabia started a power game in Yemen, but the UAE was after business. In 2006, when the war in Yemen hadn't broken out yet, and Ali Abdullah Saleh was still Yemen's president, they signed a contract to construct a city named Al-Nur, or the City of Light. After the war broke out, Emiratis built prisons of their own. Some people were reportedly tortured in the prisons. However, it was always the UAE's humanitarian aid convoys in front of the cameras. The Emiratis had learned something that Saudi Arabia hasn't even started to think about. The UAE views the countries in the region the same way the colonial UK viewed regional countries. Saudi Arabia is after attacking, occupation, and capturing the region just like a traditional government. But the UAE is after business. And it doesn't make any difference for it whether it was going to achieve this goal through prison and torture or humanitarian aid convoys. The important thing is to push things forward, especially since Yemen's energy resources, including its oil and gas, are still intact. For companies, the temptation is so big that they will even get involved in bloody games. From November 28, 2017, the streets in Sana'a were scenes of clashes between Saleh loyalists and the Houthis. On December 2nd, Saleh appeared on Yemen's state television and called on the people to wrest back the country's control from the Houthis. What had happened? Why did the alliance between Saleh and the Houthis end so quickly in a year? The Houthis answered the question 2 days later. On December 4th, 2017, Mohammed Abdul Salam, the Houthi spokesman, told Al Jazeera that Saleh had clandestine ties with Saudi Arabia and certain other Arab countries for 3 months. Saleh seemingly sided with the Ansarullah resistance, but he negotiated with enemy representatives behind the scenes and was ready to make a peace deal with them. For Abdul Malik al-Houthi, Saleh was a traitor. The street clashes by Saleh's supporters to occupy the Houthis' headquarters failed. It was strange that no domestic force could defeat the Houthis. And the big question was, if the Houthis were merely a tribal group with no relevance to the national will in Yemen, and if they didn't enjoy support from the Yemeni people, why was it so hard to defeat them? The easiest answer for bin Salman was to point the finger at Iran. Iranian officials never denied that they were supporting the Ansarullah movement and the Yemeni people, even though the support is mostly spiritual. At the same time, Iranian officials are pessimistic about bin Salman's aspirations. Bin Salman doesn't have sufficient experience to lead a region, and his short record in Yemen doesn't promise a bright future. People in Yemen are in a very tough situation. On April 21, 2015, when Saudi Arabia announced that it would temporarily halt its military operation, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman welcomed the Saudi decision because if the military operation did continue, the famine and disease in Yemen would become more widespread. International media spread the news. Western parliaments hit out at their governments for selling arms to Saudi Arabia. After a short ceasefire, Saudi Arabia resumed its heavy airstrikes. While the international image of the Saudis has been tarnished because of its heavy bombardment of Yemen, the Emiratis were secretly pushing their own agenda. They trained 35,000 Yemeni forces in Aden and other areas. They also had a plan for this strategic island named Socotra. Yemeni military forces on the island are trained by the United Arab Emirates. With their petrodollars, the Emiratis had bought mercenaries from other parts of the world as well. 1,800 paid militants from Colombia, Panama, El Salvador, Chile, and 400 mercenaries from Eritrea. It also bought off the heads of the tribes. Its influence also caused Riyadh's anger. Muslim Brotherhood is one of the oldest Islamic political parties in Egypt. Later on, it attracted many supporters in other Arab countries. They want the return of Islam in the face of nationalist and communist elements. Such parties are called brotherhood. In Yemen, there was a brotherhood party called Isla Party. Saudi Arabia supported it, but the UAE was against it. It was clear what they were going to fight over next. In Yemen's traditional society, half of the people aren't Zaydi Shias, they are Sunnis. Brotherhood supporters seek to find a bastion among the Sunnis. More extremist groups like Al-Qaeda also try to recruit forces within the social context. The majority of Sunnis in Yemen are not inclined towards radical groups like Al-Qaeda, so brotherhood parties like ISLA have a bigger chance. After the chasm opened wider, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi deposed two of his officials who had ties with the UAE. It was obvious that the Saudis were behind it. The UAE-affiliated groups formed a transitional council and announced if Hadi does not resign, they'll topple his government within 7 days. The bloody infighting among anti-Houthi forces started, this time between UAE supporters, named the Southern Transitional Council, and Saudi supporters, namely Hadi and his forces. After Hadi's palace was besieged by the UAE-backed rebels, the clashes ended with mediation efforts. But it was clear that the Saudi project in Yemen was heavily defeated. The Emiratis had thrown down the gauntlet. They thought they could defeat the Houthis within 2 weeks, but now they were wasting $1.3 million every month for an endless war, and they had to flex their muscles to their partner, namely Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman had just realized that the differences within the coalition were serious. Forget about defeating the Houthis. Large cracks had appeared within his coalition. During this period, Iran secretly provided Yemenis with food and medical supplies. Because Saudi Arabia had laid siege on Yemen, and the chances for food supplies, especially from Iran, are next to nothing. But food supply wasn't enough. If Yemenis couldn't defend themselves, the humanitarian situation in Yemen would further deteriorate. In an interview with a Chinese television network on October 1, 2019, General Mohammad Baghiri, a high-ranking Iranian military official, spoke of Iran's advisory assistance to Yemen. در مورد یمن خب راه‌های یمن کاملاً مسدود هست و امکان کمک به اونجا به شکل تجهیزات و تسلیحات وجود نداره لذا این که گفته میشه از جمهوری اسلامی ایران موشک حمل میشه به یمن دروغه و وقتی بسته کوچک دارو امکان حملش نیست چطور موشک‌های چند متری امکان حملش باشه اما کمک مستشاری و فکری ما به ارتش مردمی یمن صورت میدیم و ما در کنار مردم یمن خواهیم بود تا اینکه بتونن این تجاوز را از کشورشون دور کنن. Yemen has the second biggest army in the Arabian Peninsula after Saudi Arabia in terms of the number of forces. The Yemeni army dates back to World War I and the independence of North Yemen. It means it's older than any other army in the peninsula. But the problem of the Houthis isn't the number of forces. The war imposed by Saudi Arabia is unequal. The Saudis buy the latest U.S. warfare at exorbitant prices, but Yemen is a poor country. The solution was to somehow tip the balance to make it an equal war. It means Yemenis should be able to take advantage of being Saudi Arabia's neighbor and threaten Saudi interests by making indigenous missiles.
In the limelight.
One super spreader with Omicron shed 1,000 times as much viral RNA as those with Alpha or Delta. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Mackenzie Prillman, writer. This article is published under the heading, "How much virus does a person with COVID exhale?" New research has the answers. Stay tuned for more. People infected with the highly transmissible Alpha, Delta, and Omicron variants of SARS-CoV-2 spew out higher amounts of virus than those infected with other variants, according to a new study. Furthermore, individuals who contract COVID-19 after vaccination and even after a booster dose still shed virus into the air. The work was posted on the MedRevix preprint server on July 29th. It has not yet been peer-reviewed. John Walkins, a public health engineer at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, said, "This research showed that all three of those variants that have won the infection race come out of the body more efficiently when people talk or shout than the earliest strains of the coronavirus." The study co-author Kristen Coleman, who researches emerging infectious diseases at the University of Maryland in College Park, says this means that people should be pushing governments to invest in improving indoor air quality by improving ventilation and filtration systems. For the study, Coleman and her colleagues recruited 93 people between mid-2020 and early 2022 who were infected with SARS-CoV-2. Participants' infections were caused by strains including the Alpha variant, which emerged in late 2020, and the later Delta and Omicron variants. All participants with the latter two strains had been fully vaccinated before catching the virus. The infected people faced into a cone-shaped apparatus and sang and shouted, with the inevitable coughs and sneezes in between, for 30 minutes, while an attached machine collected the particles they exhaled. The device, called a Jasondite second, separated out the fine aerosol droplets measuring 5 micrometers or less in diameter, which can linger in the air and leak through cloth and surgical masks. The team found that participants infected with the Alpha, Delta, and Omicron variants emitted significantly more viral RNA when exhaling than did people infected with other variants. These include ancestral variants, such as the one first detected in China, and those not associated with increased transmissibility, such as Gamma, which arose in late 2020. For participants with Delta and Omicron, their fine aerosol contained on average 5 times the amount of virus that was detected in their larger, coarse aerosol. The team also seeded out cells in the lab with aerosol samples and found that 4 samples, each from a participant with either Delta or Omicron, infected the cells. Shed virus is not always infectious, says a study co-author Gianni Lai, an epidemiologist at the University of Maryland, and the sample's ability to infect lab cells means that viral RNA in exhaled aerosols can spread the disease. Malin Alsved, an aerosol technology scientist at Lund University in Sweden, said, "I'm a bit concerned that they mix all their respiratory aerosols. They have breathing, talking, speaking, screaming, coughing, even sneezing in the sample." Coleman responds that the team combined respiratory samples to mimic a real-life scenario, such as being in a restaurant. The study also highlights variation between individuals in the amounts of exhaled virus, which ranged from non-detectable levels to those associated with super spreaders. One Omicron-infected participant, for example, shed 1,000 times as much viral RNA through fine aerosol as the maximum level observed in those with Alpha or Delta. The researchers say that the root of these discrepancies remains a mystery, but could be related to biological factors such as a person's age. Behavior might play a part too. The study's super spreader coughed more frequently than others. If new variants are more prone to super spreading, that might drive them to dominate COVID-19 cases. The team notes that people infected with SARS-CoV-2 exhale much lower amounts of viral RNA than do people infected with influenza, a comparable airborne disease. This suggests that SARS-CoV-2 could spin off variants that transmit even more virus.
Tümen. Yani?
Bazaar.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses, and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains, and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features, which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the programme that analyses profits, markets, industries and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said. Let's walk through today's Bazaar.
To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Arya. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports.
Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves.
We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began manufacturing stoves, ovens, stovetop ventilation systems, and taps, among other kitchen attachments. With two factories in Shiraz and one in the capital Tehran, its production facilities can make hundreds of thousands of units annually in over 200 different models. One of these factories is solely dedicated to various molds needed to create its stylishly modern products. Early on in its manufacturing journey, this company used to import steel stencil sheets from Europe. But after becoming a subsidiary of the second largest producer of galvanized steel sheets, it began purchasing most of its raw material domestically. The company uses the latest technology to manufacture its products. Its production lines are equipped with cutting-edge automated assembly systems managed by experienced staff. Nonetheless important is the use of high-quality raw materials and strong sustainable designs are two key components in guaranteeing the long life of these kitchen appliances.
Here is a short word on the machines used in manufacturing home appliances in Iran. Many production machines and automated systems such as steel laser cutters are domestically produced. Of course, that's not to say all of them are locally made. Some still need to be imported, but it is noteworthy just how much of this equipment is already available in domestic markets.
Research and development and quality control are critical activities of this manufacturing company. The R&D department is responsible for developing new products as well as monitoring the market and customers' needs. Its quality control division is built into its production facilities. Here, items are frequently checked and tested with the latest technologies to ensure manufacturing uniformity. As you might know, this also guarantees that each item is made exactly the same, which increases the quality of the final product. The R&D and quality control departments are also responsible for implementing national and international standards, which led the way for its exports. Currently, This company not only distributes its products nationwide, but also sends its items to neighboring and Eurasian markets. This company largely attributes its success to its highly experienced and specialized staff who are in charge of various production processes. On the whole, it has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it has dozens of representative agencies across the country. Like many in the home appliance industry, this company has faced many obstacles throughout the years. But its trump card has been its unique approach to solving these challenges. For example, the US-imposed sanctions were one that this company transformed into a domestic opportunity.
Now, Iran domestically produces a lot of raw materials needed in this sector, which spares local manufacturers from spending millions on imports. What's more, domestically supplying raw materials to the home appliance industry has helped it blossom. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here's an overview of the sector and its productions, including some insight into raw materials produced in Iran.
Iran is the 10th largest steel producer in the world, just behind Brazil. However, China is the undisputed producer with nearly 100 million tons of monthly output. That's just to give you an idea of how large the country's steel sector is. It's undoubtedly important, as the country's mammoth industry feeds numerous down-the-line sectors, including home appliance manufacturing. The World Steel Association's figures show that major Iranian steel mills produced nearly 30 million tons of crude steel and products last year. It might be interesting to know that over 30% of total productions are typically exported, generating millions in foreign revenue. But that's not the only industry that supplies raw materials to the home appliance sector. Petrochemical products, such as polymers, which are used to make plastic, also contribute to the production of home appliances. Iran's Home Appliances Manufacturers Union says some 15 million household appliances were produced in the country last year. That's far beyond the original production target of 12 million units set by the government. Meanwhile, Iran exports many of these products to neighboring regions, including Asia and Africa. Last year, the total value of exports was over $300 million, according to Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. All things considered, there is a lot to look forward to regarding Iran's expanding home appliance sector.
Okay, I shall now step aside for several minutes and let my good friend and colleague guide you on an educational adventure out on the field. Take it away.
Most of you have probably thought about biking to work, or biking to most places for that matter, instead of driving. You get a little workout done in your probably sedentary lifestyle, you help the environment, you don't pay for fuel during a global energy crisis, and well, frankly, you look cool. But you never actually got to doing it, or you did it a couple times and realized that it's not for you. Maybe it was too difficult, maybe you were burned out halfway through and had to take a taxi for the rest of the way, or that you showed up too sweaty for work. If you're still, however, interested in the idea, just not so much the problems, electric bikes are just the thing for you. And just why do I say that? Well, let's imagine you are biking to work and you find yourself burned out, or you get a bad cramp and you can't pedal the bike the rest of the way. So here are your options. You take a taxi and leave the bike, which is not really an option. You go back home hoping you were less than halfway to your destination, otherwise it would be even more difficult to do that.
Or wait a good while till your energy level comes back up and miss work a little bit. None of these are elegant options, really. There is one, though. You have an electric bike, so you either don't even pedal at all for the rest of the way and just use the throttle on your electric bike, or you have the bike assist your pedaling so it's not as difficult and draining. You still get a workout done, but you're not drained completely afterwards. When he said 80% of the electronic kits are made in-house, it meant that pretty much the only thing that isn't being made here is the battery test kits and the LCDs they install on the bike handles that show you your current speed, wattage used by the motor, battery level, etc. And even that has a custom software. The 500, 750 and 1000 watt motors are made in-house and are installed in the way that you are seeing right now. Regular bikes from different brands and manufacturers are taken into the facilities and then they are prepped to have everything installed on them. There are lots of types for bikes and for each bike with its purpose, they might use a different battery capacity and motor. For example, they use a 1000 watt motor and 64 cell battery on their biggest and baddest fat bike meant for rough off-road terrain and a 500 watt motor and a 52 cell battery for their urban bikes that don't benefit too much from the extra horsepower. I mean, it's not actually horsepower, but you know what I mean.
The process that goes behind turning mundane regular bikes that are great for a workout to one that is not as good for a workout but is a lot more convenient and a lot more capable of transporting you from one place to another. So first they need to cut some holes into the chassis, precision holes into these oftentimes aluminum chassis to make room for the connections between the controller as well as the throttle on the handle and the battery pack. So once they have installed, now it's time for the electric motor, which is going to be installed on the rim. So they take the rim off, they disassemble all of the spokes on the rim, they reinstall it on the electric motor, but there's a crucial step here. They need to make sure that the screws of the spokes that are connected to the rim as well as the electric motor are completely balanced so that the rim doesn't skew to one side or the other. So they spin it to make sure it doesn't touch two screws on both sides. If it does touch it and there's friction, they need to re-tighten or re-loosen some of the screws to make sure it's completely balanced. And now, which is designed for the 500 watt electric motor, this is the entire system with the battery pack installed and the controller also attached as well as the throttle. But there's also another cool thing about this particular display and this whole system, but I'll reserve that for just a few minutes after we talk to one of the people behind this project to give us a little bit more information.
As an engineer and environmental enthusiast, I've always looked for a product to simultaneously save the health of the people and save the environment. And that's why I started a company called EVTech to manufacture electric bicycles in Iran. Currently, we are the largest e-bike manufacturer in Iran, and our bikes are tailor-made to Iranian trains. And people can use them here in our mountainous cities like Tehran easily. Our bikes are ranging from fat bikes, mountain bikes, and city bikes, and have different motors with different output powers. So you can choose from our products based on your need and your applications. At the core, we are a company that mainly manufacture power electronic components of e-bikes and electric motorcycles. We are manufacturing power electronics chargers, power electronic e-bike controllers, and also design brushless DC motors that have been used in our products and electric motors that manufactured by other companies. We also manufacture our battery packs and use very, very sophisticated battery management systems to ensure that our batteries are working in their ideal conditions and are safe to use in everyday basis.
And This is the last bit of information that I said I'd be talking about before. So the bike has its regular set of gears. You got the back gears and the front gears, but then there is display, and with this